I wanted to start with some state news from the state house. You joined a few mayors opposing legislation that would repeal the state's 80-year-old common construction wage law. Now, for those who don't know, the law determines an hourly rate that must be paid to laborers on publicly financed construction projects, though they have to cost more than $350,000. So if this passes, wages would be determined by the free market. What's right. your stand on this?
Yeah, I was surprised at how many mayors are involved. I think the last count I had was 31 mayors, and not all Democrats. This has been an interesting amalgam of opposition to this bill. This is Republican and Democrat. In the legislature as well, all the Republicans aren't supporting this, and we're not sure how it will fare in the Senate. But you've also got at the rally that was held this week, contractors, not just members of labor unions, speaking out against the bill because they realize what's at stake. This is an 80-year law that's served the state well, never been a problem. There's already a threshold of $350,000, as you note, so it doesn't apply to all projects. And I mean, the argument is it's saving taxpayer money. And I guess the big question is at what cost? And I think it's dangerous to believe that just because you've got the lowest bid, you've got the best bid. And this puts some protections in for the quality of work that gets done. The apprentice programs, although there are some efforts to amend some of those back in, are important to make sure you've got the best qualified labor building public projects. I mean, these are projects including, you know, public works projects. Bridges. We all know what happens if something goes wrong with bad construction, and it's important. These are not projects that are going to be temporary. These are long-term projects that are important to communities. You've also got the entirety of a wage level of wage earners at stake, and it's just an interesting thing that you've got Republicans who talk an awful lot about local government having control to make its own choices, here preempting local government's ability to make that choice. And also taking away middle level wage salaries from people and eroding the income base of a community. And it's just something I think is only happening, much like RFRA, because there is the supermajority in the House and Senate, and the Republicans are making the most of it. These are not things they campaigned on. They're things that are coming up and they're taking advantage of because they've got these supermajorities.
Do you think there's any middle ground on this issue that they'll be able to figure something out?
You know, I know the effort was made, the amendment was offered that put some of the apprentice programs back in, but I think that's trying to make a bad law a bit better. It doesn't mean it's still not going to be a bad law.
You mentioned about the Religious Freedom Restoration mm-hmm. Act. That was a few weeks ago, but have you heard of any fallout from the Bloomington area in terms of the kind of the controversy that was surrounding that act?
Well, yeah, I know what you mean when you say fallout in terms of business and all. We
correct,
haven't heard a
correct,
specific
yes.
thing, but mm-hmm. you know, I do think it has an impact on people who are really who are proud to be Hoosiers. Sometimes people don't even like to refer to that word because some people don't know what it means. Other people aren't sure how it's taken by other parts of the country. But you know, we had one of our department heads who was in another state on vacation during this time and said, and I don't think he was exaggerating, he said, I was asked at least 50 times when I would say where I was from, first thing they would say is, oh. And that does have an impact on you when you know that friends, family are contacting you, talking to you about how Indiana's perceived. And obviously that's not something that we just feel locally, it's something that the state of Indiana itself feels because they're putting more than $2 million into a PR contract with an out-of-state firm, ironically enough, to promote the reputation of the state, to try to resurrect the reputation of the state. So it's going to have lasting effect. I also think it seems like more of a partisan show today, but I think it's had an impact on Republicans. Republicans in town who I've talked to say this is not their Republican Party. And I don't believe that is a partisan issue. I think it certainly was driven by Republicans and they lost control of it. But not all Republicans feel the way that the governor's office, the legislative Republicans, acted on this issue. And you know, it's something that I think we won't know what the impact is in some ways. We haven't heard of formal cancellations, but you don't know who might not even take a look at coming to your state, to your community, because of what's happened.
Well, it's not a show without talking about parking. City Council is looking over some three proposals to change how they operate.
That's all Democrats.
And as you said, though, this has always been a work in progress. You were looking to fine-tune this.
Yeah.
Are you starting to see some type of agreement on where these changes are starting to head now?
Well, I don't know if there's agreement. I mean, the council has got two pretty distinct, there's a lot of commonality, but there are some pretty distinct differences, and I don't think they've worked through those yet. But yeah, generally speaking, I think we're headed toward reduced hours. I don't think it will be the 10 a.m. to 8 p.m., which is what I was suggesting. Right now we're at 8 a.m. to 10 p.m. I was suggesting 10 a.m. to 8 p.m. Both council members are talking, I think, about 9 a.m. to 9 p.m., although I did hear some talk of 9 a.m. to 8 p.m., and I would like that. I think right now it falls a little more heavily on the dinner hour visitors, people who typically aren't coming into downtown just for dinner, but are staying for show, the arts, whatever reason they might be visiting downtown. People who are volunteering downtown typically are doing that at night. So nighttime parking seems to have a more a tougher time than maybe if you're just coming in for lunch, an hour in, an hour out. But it remains to be seen what they'll do. But I think we'll do that. I think that it's likely the quote-unquote convenience fee will be eliminated, the 30-cent fee for using your credit card. And I think we'll get to a point where we can use Park Mobile, the mobile app for parking, to be able to, when you park, you start the meter, and when you leave, you stop it, as opposed to having to play meter roulette, where you have to put in a certain amount of money up front, wondering how long you might be there. And then, of course, the worst-case scenario is your meter runs out and you get a ticket, and now you've got a much more expensive parking session than you would have. And on the other hand, you know, you've got people who overpay, and while they're not getting the ticket, they have paid for time, and it does breed some more resentment for metering. So I think that would be a fair way to do it, a more predictable way to do it, and I think that's in the near future.
What about the parking garages?
Yeah, you know, that's something that I'm concerned. I was suggesting we take them down to a first hour free, which is done in other communities. I think both council members want to both council proposals want to preserve the 3 hour free. I have trouble with that because already we're seeing people who are taking advantage of that 3 hours and moving their car after 3 hours. So we used to have the 2 hour roulette. We used to have people go out and move their car every 2 hours. Now we've got people moving them after three. And it defeats the purpose of why we had free parking to begin with, if you have people going out and just moving their car from place to place. So I think all parking lots, all parking garages would have had 1 hour free, and I don't think that's likely to happen. I think we'll stay at the three, which I know many people will be happy about on the face of it, but when they realize that there are people who are moving their cars place to place and also leaving their cars in the garages longer, at their expense of being able to access the garage. You know, there is a trade-off. It's trade-offs for all of this.
One of the things that stuck out to me was, I believe Councilman Volman suggested using the app as a way to handle free parking for those who are volunteering at some of the nonprofits. Does that kind of open a door that maybe some don't want to go down?
Yeah, I don't think I want to revisit what he said. I don't think he was talking about free. It's free to the volunteer, but not
correct.
Free to the agency that those volunteers are serving.
Okay.
So I think that's the way. And it was either reduced or it was per time that was purchased by an entity that has volunteers, a nonprofit that has volunteers. And I don't know if he intends for it to be, I just don't know. He made it clear. It's my fault, not his.
No.
He was talking about is that they could buy bulk time and provide it to volunteers. Now that doesn't mean that those entities would necessarily want to or maybe even be able to afford to buy that time. But yeah, I really don't want the city government to become the arbiter of who should qualify for free parking and who shouldn't. The argument that I think if I were a small business downtown, I'd say, look, I have customers, visitors who I can't afford to be, I don't want to be in competition with nonprofits for the very same parking spaces. It's free to them, but my customers have to pay, or I have to pay for them. And it starts to stratify on-street parking in a way that I'm a bit uncomfortable with. Mm-hmm. So I understand the motive behind it is certainly a pure one, but I don't know that the intended consequence will be what the author might believe it is.
And just last question on this is just any time frame on when this can be seen through?
Yeah, you know, that's going to be up to the council. My suggestions were made in October, November, and it's taken quite a while for the council to get to them here in April. And I hope they give us a chance to implement. We've got to do new signage and get new enforcement procedures in place. So, but my preference would be that they get done during the summertime when parking is a bit more relaxed, and then have everything in place for by the time the new semester begins.
The Herald Times did a special report this past week on the high-tech hopes, digging into Bloomington's tech park and whether it can succeed. One of the items that kind of stuck out to me reading through that was housing. It kind of comes to that, like, what comes first, you know, the chicken or the egg. Can a major tech employer locate here if there isn't anything more than that college apartment housing? You know, or how do you build housing without the client?
Yeah, well, I mean, I guess the best way to answer that is that there are a lot of tech firms that already have located here, with, and there are downtown without that kind of dedicated housing. So, you know, I can tell you that the preference would be to have them done simultaneously. In reality, it's very unlikely that will happen, and we'll work with whatever works best first. And you know, we're trying to work with developers on getting those things being done simultaneously. If they have a tenant already to go, then that's what they'll want to do first. Otherwise, they're going to want to do housing first because that's where the revenue stream is fastest. But you know, we're not interested, again, in downtown simply being an expansion of what already is, meaning we aren't just looking for more student housing. We're looking for, you know, workforce affordable housing. We're looking for year-round residential. And to have some balance in the demographic in downtown. We've seen the city, as we've talked on this show many times about, 12 years ago, the city was attempting to bring people to live downtown, to stop sprawl, to stop student apartment complexes from being built in neighborhoods. The decision was made to try to concentrate that kind of growth in the city's center. And that's worked extremely well, to the point where there are now people feeling the pendulum has swung too far the other way. And so we're looking to try to establish demographic balance in downtown, and the 12 acres presents that great opportunity. The question is, who's willing to invest in it? At what cost? At what cost are we willing to provide incentives to induce that kind of construction? Because developers want that student housing. It's bigger money, faster money. So there will be an expense to the tech park, to the 12 acres that we purchased, to make the development that we want to happen there.
The article points out that Bloomington rates number two spot for small cities. And you know, we always hear the positives that Bloomington has, but maybe besides that housing conflict, what are some of the other things that the city is fighting in developing a tech park?
Well, you know, I guess, you know, in part, I want to make clear, in my mind, this isn't just a tech park. That's how that's emblematic of what the land has become known, but really a small percentage of that 12 acres will actually be tech employment. This is meant to be mixed use, residential, green space, as well as tech employment. So part of the challenge is trying to identify, you've also got the historic preservation aspect. We'll be designating the old showers buildings that are there, and there are costs. There are costs to saving, preserving buildings. There's cost to trying to get a developer to do something that they wouldn't normally do, because that's not where the money is. That's not where the investment will have its biggest dividend. So that's where the challenge comes, is trying to keep it in balance, not give away the store, at the same time provide the proper incentive to get people to expand downtown with a community vision, not just with a bottom line vision. And that's the balance we're trying to achieve.
How does this tech park work with or not work with what IU is trying to do over on the north part of town?
Yeah, sometimes people talk about the competition. I can tell you there's no competition, because we'd get steamrolled. I mean, the city government can't compete with that. I mean, you look at just the acreage, the money, the impetus, the state government support. I mean, there was never any vision that this was a competition. It's very much been a cooperative effort. In fact, the university served on the panel that develop plans for the tech park, for the certified designation that we have of that land. They were supportive of, and we hope. I mean, in a dream world, we would see that businesses that are either too small to go in the tech park at IU, 10th and the Bypass, or that are spinoff from 10th and the Bypass, would be interested in locating in downtown. That the quality of life, the amenities of downtown, the ability to be able to live, work within walking distance, to have all the different restaurant, arts venues available to you, the entertainment venues, that it's a quality of life issue that people will want to locate. And it's also the culture of the tech world, is that they feed off of one another's ideas and the synergies that are realized from communication and cooperation. And I think that that's what we are at least envision with the downtown. The tech part, the 10th and the Bypass, is much bigger firms, much bigger research and development. And so really we have had nothing but cooperation between the two. And I hope that we'll see the spinoff effect of 10th and the Bypass in our downtown.
Is there any spinoff from other places outside of the IU Tech Park or the city? I was looking at Purdue's Research Park. Yeah. They have three or four throughout the state, and one of the largest in the state in West Lafayette.
Yeah, you know, can you restate the question in terms of the spinoff?
Yeah, you're talking about the spinoff and how these two help each other.
Right.
What about outside of Bloomington?
Sure. You know, right now we've had some communities coming to look at us and what we're doing in our downtown and are developing their business sector, their downtown sector, based on what they see in Bloomington. We're doing the same. You know, we're going out and looking at Fishers and areas that we've done road trips to see what's working elsewhere for a medium-sized city and what we can expect to work here. But, you know, one of the best recruiters for us won't be government. It's going to be the private sector itself, and the BEDC, through our Bloomington Tech Partnership, the city and BEDC have had a cooperative venture where the city is helping to fund BEDC, and that word of mouth and the tech firms themselves in town, the word of mouth that goes through their professional sectors has helped to draw attention to us. Now, what needs to happen, though, is most of those are firms that don't have the initial capital to buy a building or build a building. So what we're looking for are private developers interested in working with those kind of tech firms to be either their landlord or to at least to invest in the construction of buildings so that those firms will locate downtown.
It's been a couple months since we've talked about this. Has anything progressed more in terms of the development of that area now?
Yeah.
And the strengthening of, you talked about 10th Street and so forth.
Yeah, there's a few things that have continued to happen. We've continued to work with developers and the tech businesses themselves, and I hope that we'll have something formal we can get going on in the next few months. The other is the infrastructure. And so we'll be going to the Redevelopment Commission. We'll be looking with, we've talked in this show about the consolidation of the TIFs and our ability to issue bonds in order to pay for some of those infrastructure improvements. So, you know, we're already looking at streets, including the straightening of 10th Street, which impacts a private landowner, by the way, so we have to be sensitive to how that will play out. It goes right through a parking lot, and so we're looking at trades there and how we can compensate the private owner for the inconvenience to their firm. But also the water sewer tech itself, the infrastructure that has to go in. So all that will continue to move. And I expect this year for those plans to be in place. And I don't know whether we'll actually see construction begin on that. The first thing that had to happen was the clearing of the land. And honestly, we were ahead of schedule on that. So that's been a big benefit to be able to market the acreage, just to show how serious we are about it. The other thing that will be happening in the next month or so is the historic designation of those buildings. So there's a lot happening at one time to make the entirety work.
Last question, what's the number one thing on your desk right now?
Number one thing on my desk right now, well, I have two. One is I'll be giving my last talk to the Downtown Bloomington Inc. And they asked me to talk about my top 10 list for the city and downtown. So it's been a time to reflect, but also a time to look forward as I'm thinking back to what wasn't there 10 years ago and what will be there 10 years from now. But probably the next biggest thing continues to be the consolidation of those TIFs and getting ready to go to the Redevelopment Commission and into the City Council with a bond issuance that can help to fund an awful lot of the priorities that you and I have talked about for years. The Certified Tech Park, the Switch Yard, affordable housing in downtown Bloomington.